Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And this is Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, your host. And today, I have two of the eminent musicians of Southern California sitting right here in the studio, and we're not even going to talk about them. I have Don McKellar, who is here, and I have James Drollinger. And both of these two men have an incredible, fantastic music career of their own, and I promise we'll bring them back. But today we're doing a show all about our friend and colleague, Paul Solomonovich. Paul was an eminent teacher. He was a master of chant. He was at St. Charles Borromeo for 60 years. He was a knight of the Pope. He was everything. And for the three of us, he was a very special person, especially Dom and Jim. So welcome, my friends. How good to have you.
It's a pleasure. It's Thank you.
Here. Thank you for being here. Well, Dom is at Padre Serra Parish in Camarillo. He's been there since 1999. That's about the time. When did I meet you the first time, Don?
We met in 1995.
Oh, okay. So you weren't there yet.
Yeah.
We did a little teaching together at Mount St. Mary College, and it was a pleasure to meet you then. And it's great to see you again. It's been such a long time, way too long. You were 18 seasons with the Master Chorale. You got your degree with Paul there at Loyola Marymount, went on to Fullerton for your master. So you have intimate knowledge of the master that we're going to talk about today. And Jim Drollinger is the now music director and liturgist at St. Charles Borromeo, Paul's parish, for 60 years.
It was a pleasure.
How do you follow somebody that's there 60 years?
That's a tough one. We just do the best we can to honor the quality and the tradition. We hope that we're successful in all.
Well, we're going to talk a lot about that on this program. We're going to talk about his years with the Master Chorale. We're going to talk about his years at St. Charles, his years at Loyola Marymount. And so we just have to dive in because there's too much to dwell on these two guys. But we'll be back to these two guys in future shows, I promise you, radio listeners. So let's talk about Paul's very beginning.
Well, he was born in 1927, and he attended St. James Catholic Church and school in Redondo Beach, and it was there that he caught the musical bug. A young priest by the name of Father Louis Buchner began a boys' choir, which sang nothing but chant, and he was really, really caught up in all of that. And by his own admission, it was that chant music-making that's influenced his music-making throughout his entire conducting career.
Well, and it's true, any time you were with Paul, whether you were working on a piece of chant or polyphony or just a piece of Martin Lawrence or anybody, chant influenced the way he saw that score.
Absolutely.
You know, I can still hear him say, you want your choir to sing in unison? You want your choir to have a beautiful sound? Teach them chant.
Yeah, absolutely. It just occurred to me, I was at St. James not long ago, and I noticed the acoustic in that building. It could not have hurt his initial impressions.
Oh, yeah, that's often the case, isn't it? You know, people that sing chant go, well, that's not too interesting because what's missing is the building, the space, you know.
Right.
When I was in the 8 seconds of the St. Louis Cathedral, young college choirs or high school choirs would come and they'd sing a piece that they thought was okay until they heard it in that environment, and it was amazing. So Paul really got a great dose of, do we know anything about this young priest? Was he an amazing musician? Or
I'm not sure, but it was enough to give Paul an experience that he latched onto. And while he was there, a young, brash, up-and-coming choral director by the name of Roger Wagner came to St. James and gave a concert.
Aha.
And Paul was again smitten. And Paul eventually found out that Roger was directing music at St. Joseph's downtown. And Paul would ride the streetcar from Redondo Beach to downtown L.A. just to observe the rehearsals. So this was definitely sort of a sign of things to come for Paul.
Can you imagine somebody that we so revere, like Paul, being smitten with anybody? You know, I mean, Paul's the one that we think is amazing.
It's true.
Yeah. We were talking about the commute from Redondo Beach to downtown L.A. today. It would never happen today. And there aren't any streetcars.
No streetcars, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So then he moved on to Blessed Sacrament Church.
Yes, the family moved to Hollywood. He ended up at Blessed Sacrament Church. He auditioned for a wonderful director and organ teacher by the name of Richard Keys Biggs, who was a prominent Catholic musical figure here in Los Angeles. He also happened to be Roger Wagner's organ teacher. And while Paul was actually still a little young for the choir, Biggs made an exception and took him into the Men and Boys Choir.
What age would he have been at that point?
Young teenager.
Probably 12, 13, something along that.
But change voice. So
he may have been singing alto initially.
Who knows, yeah. But he had a beautiful voice nonetheless. Oh, Paul's, yeah. We're going to hear a little bit about that in just a second. So somehow he got hooked up with Roger Wagner in mm-hmm. all of these things, organ recitals, observing rehearsals.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and when Roger founded the Los Angeles
Concert Youth Chorus.
Yes, Paul, I believe, was a founding member of that. 1946, and it was that L.A. Concert Youth Chorus that eventually became the Roger Wagner Chorale.
Now, I don't think of the Roger Wagner Chorale as youth, but did it start that way?
I believe it did. He met some other pretty prominent people that were members. Most notably would have been Marnie Nixon and a very young Jackie Horn, as we know her, Marilyn Horn.
Marilyn Horn, yeah, exactly.
She used to often spend the night at Paul and Dottie's house, and she would be warming up in the mirror in the morning. So a nice, nice thing to wake up to, I suppose.
And Dottie, of course, was Paul's wife.
Yep.
For so many years. Met her at Loyola Marymount, yes?
No, they met at Hollywood High School.
Actually. Okay, even before college. Yes. Wow, isn't that something?
And
high school sweethearts.
Yeah, as they say, that behind every great man, there's a greater woman. Well, Dottie was pretty great and continues to be
exactly.
You know, when you're on the road as much as Paul is, somebody had to raise the kids, and she really did a fun
and job. Hold it together.
Yeah.
Yes, Karen Romeri story. Yeah. Well, Paul joined with Roger and this concert youth chorus of Los Angeles in 1946. But by 1948, he was the assistant director.
Isn't
right?
that something?
Yeah.
For somebody who didn't fancy himself a conductor and didn't really aspire to that, he certainly had something innate that had been tapped.
So by 1964, this Roger Wagner Chorale had morphed into the L.A. Master.
Right, with the advent of the Music Center and the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, with the resident orchestra of the L.A. Philharmonic, we had a resident, the beginnings of a resident professional chorus, the Los Angeles Master Chorale. And some say there was no rival at that time.
Well, and still, I mean, I drive all the way into L.A. every time they open their mouth. They're just fantastic.
Yeah.
And Graham has done such a great job of continuing that Solomonovich sound, shall we say, that they just did the anniversary of the Lux Aeterna. And, oh, my gosh, it was just a marvelous concert. Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, that Lux Aeterna would not exist had it not been for Paul, I think.
Well,
it's really written for him, and he's in every note, according to Morten Lauritsen.
Yeah.
Every single note.
It's true. I remember being in St. Louis, bringing him for a workshop. We're going to talk a lot more about his workshops and his master classes. And he brought me the score in handwriting. And said, John, you've got to do this piece. This is a marvelous piece. And first the O Magnum. That was on the first trip. Then came others. But, you know, it was so his sound. And he would play. He did a little workshop for my music directors in the diocese. And he played a recording of the Master Chorale singing the O Magnum. I mean, well, these people had never heard a sound like that. You know, and before you knew it, in the same workshop, we all had that sound, you know.
Right.
I mean,
right.
He just beat it into us. You know?
Well, that was one of his great gifts, was to be able to create his sound pretty much wherever he went. And it was whether or not it was professional singers, amateur singers, young singers,
it
old singers.
It didn't make any difference.
He could
somehow
find that sound.
That Solomonovich sound.
I think his real gift, too, was inspiring the singers to fall in love with that sound.
Yeah.
Achieving critical mass when he started with an untrained ensemble or an ensemble with a different idea of what an ideal sound was, somehow he could sell it. And then they could sell it. It was amazing.
Well, some was his own voice, that he had such a beautiful instrument himself that he really could demo that sound. But yet, you know, in his head, he was hearing chant. He was hearing that beautiful, long, gorgeous line.
It's true.
And he could take any piece of polyphony and translate it right into that. Well, we're going to hear a little bit of Paul actually singing right now, a little Panis Angelicus of Franck. Tell us about
There's
that.
An interesting story, legend, folklore, you call it what you want. Apparently, in the studio, when this recording was made, this was from House of the Lord, a 1957 recording.
With the Roger Wagner
With the Roger Chorale. Wagner Chorale. Yeah. And during the recording session, Roger somehow just was not pleased with the soloist and how he was interpreting it. And then he was known to say, "You're too Protestant."
Oh,
so he said, "Solomonovich, get up there and sing it." And I think it was intended just to demo it, but he loved it so much that Paul became the soloist for the recording.
Oh, isn't that great? Well, we're going to hear a little bit about that. We will be back in just a moment after this little cut, and we're going to talk about his life at St. Charles Borromeo, some great stories coming there, his life at Loyola Marymount, his life on the road, his life with the L.A. Master Chorale. So don't go away. We will be right back. This is Music from the Tower, and your host, John Romeri. Stay tuned. This is Music from the Tower, and this is John Romeri, your host. Today, we are honoring and talking all about our friend Paul Solomonovich, master teacher, master chant master, just one of the great musicians, not just of Southern California, but really the world. Everybody knew Paul's name anywhere, and we have two leading experts here, Dominic McCaller and Jim Drollinger. Both of these two men knew Paul so well, and Jim actually has been the music director now at St. Charles Borromeo following Paul, but was also there with Paul. Tell us a little bit about that, and we'll get to how Paul became the music director.
I started singing with Paul at the church in the late 80s. And
as cantor.
First as a choir member. And then a couple of years down the line, a cantor position opened up, and I was just supremely honored that he would ask me to do it. So that kind of got me really started in the parish. And I did that probably since 1990 until such time as, in 09, I became his successor. A privilege I can't even begin to describe.
Well, Paul went there in 1949, but by very suspect.
Yes, well, his predecessor there was Roger Wagner. And at a certain point in Roger's career, he just had other opportunities that he needed to be able to take advantage of. And he told Paul, you're going to take over for me. And Paul said, no, I don't think I am. And Roger said, yes, you are. But Roger, I'm not an organist or a conductor. Oh, yes, you are, Paul. You'll be just fine. So Roger gave Paul one conducting lesson. He taught him one hymn on the organ, which happened to be the favorite hymn of the pastor, Monsignor Harry Mead. And when the three of them met, Roger did quite a sell job and assured Monsignor Mead that Paul could play and could conduct and that he would be just fine. Paul played that one tune that he could play on the organ, and he got the job.
Isn't that something? That is the greatest story of all mankind. Now, if I were diocesan director, as I'd been in so many dioceses, I would shoot myself. But here's this great pastor hiring this kid who conducted one song and played one song on the organ. But sometimes it's much worse than that, I'm sorry to say, in many of our parishes. Yeah.
Well, it actually was in this case, too. I mean, I heard from Paul himself that the first thing he did when he got the job was get masking tape and put The names of the keys on the organ manuals.
Names of the notes?
The names of the notes.
Isn't that funny? Oh, my gosh. Poor Paul. So he really wasn't a great organist or pianist at that point.
Not at that point. And you know, the thing about him over his career, he would let you know that he was kind of a self-made guy. And he really was. I mean, in every sense of that word, he worked his tail off to prepare for any whatever the job was. If it was playing the organ as the music director, you know, he had to really practice hard. And if he had to learn a new score, he would study like crazy, like no one I've ever known. But it made him who he is.
Well, and he probably didn't come to this position as a great organist choir master would play and conduct. But I think that's probably, at least in one of the things I read before this show, was about his facial expressions. You know, I mean, Paul had the greatest face to inspire a choir. It was amazing. And he probably just, I mean, I developed a stink eye over all those years that I could look over the organ rack and disintegrate a singer. And I think Paul probably had that very same look, you know, that he could handle the choir and still keep his hands on the keys.
It's true. The facial expressions were pretty paramount. And I would assume that he learned that through his own experience as a choir singer, both for Roger and for Dr. Biggs. So he had good teachers, and he learned the lessons, and he imparted them with great success.
Well, anybody that's going to ride the trolley to observe is going to be one of those little sponges that soaks in everything.
That's exactly right.
Exactly. Well, there was only a volunteer adult choir, about 50 to 75 voices there. There was not any paid staff singers or anything else, but he also had a children's choir. Tell us a little bit about that.
That children's choir was through St. Charles School, and he maintained that that was his life's blood throughout his entire career because of his love for teaching. And you talk about little sponges. He found that these little kids could be little sponges as well. And he would constantly kind of compare us to them to say, why don't you learn the lessons the way the kids do? So we knew we were being held to a very high
standard. Well, and they didn't sing any rinky-dink little children's songs either.
No,
they sang chant.
They sang pretty serious Catholic repertoire, whether it was hymns or chant.
Mass said.
Well, the interesting thing in his early years as conductor, I think a lot of his inherited singers were still pretty loyal to Roger, and I'm not sure that he was getting the sound that he wanted out of the soprano section. And at one point, he got enough resistance that he was inclined to essentially fire them. So he removed them and replaced them with his children's choir.
All sopranos went, and in came the children?
That's right.
Isn't that great?
And I think that several of his sopranos returned at a certain point as well. They realized
we're welcome back.
He's for real.
But his children's choir was so great, they did the recording for The Small World at Disneyland, right?
The original recording, there was an LP. I think how did they build them? The Disneyland?
Yeah, the Disneyland singers or the Disneyland chorus.
Children's chorus or something. It was an album of folk songs, international folk songs. And yes, it was for the original. It's a Small World. The St. Charles School Choir was that original chorus.
Well, and he certainly loved kids and was great with kids. I taught a few years with him at Pueri Cantoris workshops, and he was just amazing, especially talking about what children could actually accomplish.
Yeah.
You know, that they don't need to sing junk. And they really can sing the great music of the church, which, you know, that's been an inspiration for me, too. But I can't imagine him being there 60 years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
And that time spanned through the changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so how did Paul survive all that?
Barely at times, I think. But he was a survivor, to be sure. So he figured out how to negotiate the changing liturgical waters and still deliver what he felt was, you know, a really great and wonderful musical product.
Because his choir still sang full mass settings, full choral mass settings.
Correct. And they were Latin, and a lot of them were by Richard Keys Biggs.
Wow.
There would be some Vittoria, some Palestrina. It kept him in the game, to be sure.
I remember one very funny phone call from Paul. He goes, John, as he only could do, you won't believe this, but I was away and I came back and my parish bought a book called bread breaking, breaking bread, something like that. I don't know what to do with this book, he told me. I said, well, Paul, welcome to the rest of the Catholic world, you know. We don't know what to do with that book either. Well, I think we should hear a little bit of the St. Charles Borromeo Choir. That choir sang for popes, went on tours, sang all over the place. It wasn't like that was a nice parish choir, and all of his real professional work was with the master chorale.
We sang for Pope John Paul II, Pope St. John Paul II, in a private audience, won one tour, and then the next tour, it was on the Feast of Saints Peter and Paul, the outdoor mass presided over by the Pope. It was we had some wonderful opportunities in that choir. In 2001, we recorded a Christmas CD called Peace on Earth, and it was, you know, a mixture of traditional and non-traditional kind of motets and things, but all, of course, Christmas texts. And one of the really beautiful settings by Ken Neufeld, who is a local composer who many of us know, a composer and arranger, called The Lamb, on a text by William Blake, and just a sublime setting, and we're very proud of the recording that the St. Charles Choir did of The Lamb.
Well, and we're going to hear The Lamb right now, and when we come back, we are going to talk a lot more about Paul, now his years at Loyola Marymount, and of course, in our final segment, the Master Chorale. So we will be right back with Dom and Jim, and a lot more about our friend Paul Solomonovich. Stay tuned. This is Music from the Tower. This is Music from the Tower, and today we are talking about our dear friend and mentor, Paul Solomonovich. And we're doing so with Jim Drollinger and with Dom McKellar. And now we're going to talk about Paul. Paul could really be seven or eight shows in a row here because he had such a career, such a gifted career, and touched so many lives. Now we're going to talk about Loyola Marymount, where he was a teacher for 27 years, the director of choral activities and a professor of music. Of course, he was also 18 years at St. Mary's, Mount St. Mary's College. And was really a teacher to all of us all over the country through his workshops, his recordings, his videos. So let's talk a little bit about his years at Loyola and where you two came to find him.
I got to Loyola because I was drifting and my parents realized I needed a push in some sort of productive, positive direction. And they arranged for me to go down and meet Paul. And I didn't really know what I was doing or who he was or why this was important. But I went and spent the first day of the spring semester with him. And he auditioned me He had me bring my guitar, of all things, and he had me play a St. Louis Jesuit song, of all things. And it's embarrassing to even say that, but because I found out later his attitude about these things.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
But, I'm sure he was impressed, though.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, I ended up going there. But that day, I watched him in action, and I saw him as a teacher. I sat through his choral conducting class. I sat through his sight reading class. And then I went to the rehearsals of the women's and the men's choruses. And by the end of the day, I knew what I wanted to do with my life, and I knew what kind of person I wanted to be.
Wow.
It was really dramatic.
How many people can say that about a teacher touching you in one day like that? I mean, had you met Paul before?
I had not.
Wow. So just experience him on the college campus.
Yeah. And just watching him with the students, he is a gifted teacher before anything else.
Well, and people all over the country listening to this will say, yes, I had Paul in a choral festival here, or I saw him at ACDA, the American Choral Directors Association. All of these places where Paul would take a choir or be the clinician, or in a previous show we talked with Father Virgil Funk, and all the music was from Paul doing a honors choral festival for the NPM, the National Pastoral Musicians. So Paul touched lives everywhere.
Yeah.
But tell us a little bit more about his work there at Loyola.
I'll invite Jim to chime in at any time, but I know that he was recruited there by a wonderful Jesuit named Richard Trame, who was also a history professor and the university archivist, but was a great lover of choral music. He discovered Paul up at Mount St. Mary's, and he just knew that at that time, Loyola University needed a choral conductor of that quality. So he recruited him. He got there in 64, I believe.
That sounds right.
And
64 to 91.
Right, and it was an all-men's college at the time.
Wow. Oh, I didn't know that part.
And it had a glee club. And one of the first things Paul did was change the name from the Loyola Glee Club to the Loyola Men's Chorus.
Well, you know, especially on the East Coast, I guess, with the Ivy League choirs, they all have these glee clubs. And I brought several to the cathedral in St. Louis in our concert series, and they sang these glorious pieces. But Glee Club would not do for our friend Paul.
No, there was a certain connotation there that just didn't work for him. And he made us a chorus, to be
yes,
sure.
He did. And if we sounded like a Glee Club, in his opinion of what that sounded like, he would stop the rehearsal and make fun of us. And there was this little chant, collegiates, collegiates. Yes, we are collegiates. And we knew.
Oh, listen to you two.
We knew that we better shape up.
Yeah, whatever it was, we knew we weren't doing the right thing at that point.
Well, and you two were at Loyola Marymount at the very same time.
Right? Yes,
Dominic
we
and I met at LMU, and it didn't take long at all for us to become fast friends. And
partners in crime.
Well, and yeah. Maybe not always the best example in a rehearsal, because we'd sit there and cut up and have a good time. And
yeah.
Even though we were very serious about what we were doing, but we could be a little distracting to some of our fellow singers. So
that's where Paul developed his stink eye. I see.
Perhaps.
Yeah. Perhaps. We were targets more than once.
Yep.
We used to like to breathe at the wrong time so the guy in front of us would make a wrong entrance.
Oh, jeez. You're awful.
So cruel.
Listen, cathedral singers. Do not listen to these yeah. two men.
Well, that was a magical time for both of us, I think, because that LMU men's chorus was somewhat like a fraternity, although without the debauchery so much. But it was just a great bunch of guys with wonderful camaraderie, and Paul was right there kind of at the fore.
Yeah.
He really enjoyed working with us men. And I would contrast that to the way that he worked with the women, who their rehearsals were right before ours, and usually when we would start our rehearsal, he was in kind of a sour place, but within 10 minutes, he was laughing, joking, having a good time. And I would tell my now wife about, oh, gosh, Paul was so funny today. And she's, what do you mean he was funny? He was a jerk. Oh, he was horrible. So I went to some of the rehearsals, and I could see there was a big difference in how he worked with the women as to how he worked with the men. And like I said, we were like a big frat.
When Marymount joined Loyola University is when the women came along?
Yes. And I didn't realize this, but I began singing at Loyola Marymount in 76 and started going on tour in 78, I guess, with the choruses. But what I didn't realize was that the women's chorus was still young and was not – they didn't go on the first couple of tours that I went on. He brought in women from – well, our mixed chorus was called the Consort Singers. And so it would be the men's chorus and the Consort Singers. You'd have about maybe 20 women and 40 to 50, or about 50 men. And it was a big deal that, well, now you wait a second. This women's chorus has been around for a while, and they're getting so much better. So it was a significant thing when they were allowed to come on the tour.
Yeah. And what are some places you toured?
We always did a Bay Area tour, so Danville, San Francisco, Carmel. Wow. Carmel Mission was always a real highlight for us.
Oh, such a beautiful space.
Well, and we had a wonderful reception there from the Sarah Club would always really take good care of us there.
Was it always a cappella singing or accompanied?
It was... Oh, there was a lot of a cappella, but we had an unbelievable accompanist by the name of Robert Hunter, who had been Roger's accompanist with the Roger Wagner Chorale. But Bob could take a spinet piano and make it sound like a concert grand. And he would fill it out as if it was an orchestra. He was one of the most amazing accompanists either of us has ever had a chance to work with. He and Paul were like partners in crime. They were fast friends.
And some of these choruses went to ACDA, went to the choral directors. So.
Yes, we did do national ACDAs. Sort of the first really big one we did was 1987 when the men's chorus went to San Antonio. And we, if I do say so myself, we kind of brought the house down. It was really a really wonderful experience. And then 2 years later, our ladies went to Louisville to the National ACDA Convention, American Choral Directors Association. And, you know, Paul was such a master programmer. He could put on a show that would span centuries and styles, and every bit of it was stylistically correct. And he would do that sometimes in different programming for different groups. So, for instance, the ladies, when they went, they did things like Stravinsky folk songs and really heavy-duty eclectic music, French folk songs. And then the men's chorus, we would do our requisite when we went to San Antonio. We did some Renaissance and we did some chant.
I'm sure.
But then we ended with this a Western medley of cowboy songs and a spiritual that was composed by our accompanist, Robert Hunter, I'm Going to Sing, O Lord. It was all about the showmanship for Paul.
Wow. That's gutsy to get up in front of the ACDA, the American Director of Choral Music.
Well, it's as gutsy to do that as to sing cowboy songs in San Antonio.
Exactly. Yeah, there you go.
But what gave those legitimacy was the front end of the program that was challenging and eclectic in its nature. So.
Well, and of course, Paul didn't always go with his choir. Sometimes he came. He came several times for me to the various cathedrals I've served as a choral clinician. You know, Paul would come and just in a few days or sometimes a day and then a concert, take these singers and turn them into little Solomonovich disciples for sure, hearing all the stories, certainly the story of when the Pope came into St. Vivianus, all of those things, you know, he would have them hooked. They could all tell the story the next time he came. They all listened so intently, but hearing him create that sound with our choirs. There's some wonderful documentaries. There's a DVD of Paul's work, which is just a treasure that I love so much. Recordings. I know I still have the recordings of his work in St. Louis, especially with my choirs, festival choirs. But now we're going to hear a little bit of the Loyola Marymount University Men's Chorus. And you mentioned this piece already, the folk songs of the frontier.
Yeah, we did a Western medley that was put together by Roger Wagner. Pretty significant in this is the accompaniment, which was never written down by Bob Hunter. Now, I'll say that a published version did exist with a written accompaniment, but you never knew what Bob was going to do to play it. And again, the showmanship is quite evident in both the singing and the playing.
Well, and we're going to hear a little bit of that right now. And when we come back, of course, the pinnacle of Paul's career, his work with the LA Master Chorale. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is Music from the Tower.
Oh, give me a home where above the
as you can hear in the background, you're hearing a little bit of the beautiful chant from Christmas itself, from Christmas Day, Pueri Natus, by the L.A. Master Chorale. This is Paul conducting, and you're listening to Music from the Tower, and today we are talking about Paul Solomonovich, our dear friend, our mentor, our conductor extraordinaire, and in this last segment, we're going to talk about his work with the L.A. Master Chorale.
Before we go too far into that, I just want to say that that little snippet of chant, I'm so glad that that got recorded because, you know, everybody knew of Paul as a chant master, but this, to me, this was just a sublime example of everything he asked for in regards to chant. And then that being the foundation of the rest of his music making, this was just an excellent example. So thank you for playing that.
Well, it's a piece that he constantly started workshops with, you know. He would come to our cathedrals around the country and NPM and other places, but we'd always get to hear the Master Chorale's recording of that chant because it sort of launched everything else that we did in that day or in those workshops. So how long was he with the Master Chorale? And let's hit some of the highlights.
Well, as music director, 1991 to 2001, so a full 10 years. And it was a wonderful 10 years. I was there with him for all 10 of them. I wasn't automatically let in. I had to audition just like everybody else, but it felt good to be able to be a little bit validated in that regard.
Well, we're glad you got in.
And I am,
Jim,
believe me,
just
so,
by the skin of your teeth.
I had to audition 3 times to get in. And, you know, if I thought that having had him as a college teacher was going to be any kind of entree, I was sadly mistaken.
Oh, my God.
And when I finally did get in, I was so thrilled.
And how many members of the chorus was there at that time during Paul's stay?
Were we around
120?
I think 120.
Well, and Paul did not follow Roger Ragnar directly, did he, even though he was the assistant conductor all those years?
He did audition when Roger retired, but was passed over. And when he did finally achieve the directorship, I think he had a stated goal. What was that goal, Dom?
It was to reset the sound because the interim director between Wagner and Paul had allowed a very kind of top-heavy soprano dominant sound. Actually, I'll just stop there.
A different sound.
Right. A different sound. And he said publicly, I think, in an L.A. Times interview when he took over, that that was going to be his first task.
Well, and the L.A. Times said shortly after he took over, the panache is back. Paul Solomonovich has restored the L.A. Master Chorale to its former glory. That's a quote right out of the paper. So that's pretty good in my book, and that glorious sound is still quite evident today. I know even from the stage that some of that beautiful sound is still responsible to Paul's work. And Paul was an assistant conductor, so some of that sound was really Paul's from the very beginning, would you say?
No question about it.
Yeah, to varying degrees, Paul did a lot of the prep work for Roger, whether it was for a Philharmonic appearance or for an upcoming Master Chorale performance. Paul would do a really great job of directing. And I'd say that's pretty good for a guy who never considered himself really on the trajectory to become a director.
And I might add that in many of those cases, Paul was working with the 80 or so that were left behind when Roger took the 20 or so most accomplished on tour. So while they were on tour, Paul would prepare the chorus for, you know,
whatever
Jim said, a big Philharmonic
up.
Thing coming up. And, he certainly set that sound.
And, of course, like many of these symphony choruses, you're preparing the chorus, but you're actually not conducting the concert.
That's right.
I mean, he was preparing the chorus for people like Stravinsky and people like Boulez and all sorts of other...
Zubin Mehta.
Yes, all these other conductors who would come in expecting the chorus to be note perfect and have a glorious sound.
And I'll just add, and at the same time, we were told that we had to be able to change tempo, interpretation, anything the conductor asked for on a dime in the first rehearsal.
That's right.
Right, exactly. You know, I mean, to not know what the tempo is going to be, what it's going to be like. Paul was committed to making sure choral music transcended the notes and the rhythm, and it was part of your soul. This is a quote from Lawrenson, and it's true, isn't it, that Paul had the music in him, and somehow it was in you.
Passion is a word that doesn't even come close to describing what Paul possessed when it came to music making, and that he could impart that in ways that sometimes would come off as anger, but it was really just the depths of the passion of the music making that he was trying to communicate.
Yes, he really had that passion in him, didn't he?
Always.
And sometimes it seemed like growling, I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it really was. He just, no doubt he could hear it, and he couldn't be satisfied until we could produce it, you know, as a chorus member.
Yeah.
That intensity, the experiencing the intensity and passion. And for him, also understanding the text, you know, that was a big thing, getting the text so clean. And
getting the text, but also, and I learned this from him, Dominic and I both learned this from him long ago, that the tone has to tell the story. That a dynamic is not simply a loud or a soft on a page, it's an emotion. So act the part, act the text, make sure that the person that walks in from Siberia that doesn't speak our language can understand what we're singing just by way of the tone.
Yes, and the passion.
And furthermore, make sure the English speaker in the audience doesn't know, oh, there's a mezzo piano in bar 40.
Exactly. Oh, look, it tells them to get louder.
Yes, that it gets louder because your soul couldn't do anything but
exactly.
Get louder. You know, I mean, I constantly preach that same Solomonovich. One of the things all my choirs know is the Solomonovich head swivel, where
oh, right.
You would sing over here, and then you'd have to have a space of silence in the middle, and then you'd turn your head the other way. And
that's right.
That cleanness, so there'd be no scooping from one note to the other. Mm-hmm. So all my choirs know how to swivel their heads and have that moment of silence in the middle. And so many other things with Paul. Peeking over your neighbor's fence at the apex of a chant phrase, just peek over the top and see what they're up to over
that's
there.
Right.
Give us some more, Paul.
Well, he had some wonderful little sayings that it started to become very familiar to us. So, you know, when you make music with somebody long enough and with the same people, you become like a family. So he had things like, he would say, like, my motto is, good sight reading is memorization of pitch. It's hard to argue with that one. My motto is, you can't have the pitch without the tone. And then he'd say, my motto is, you can't have the tone without the pitch. So trying to illustrate that you got to have both or you don't have anything. One of his favorite mottos, keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Well,
I think he might have borrowed that one from a certain movie, but to me that always meant if you're sitting in the front row, you're not necessarily his friend.
Yeah. That's where all choir directors keep their singers.
Exactly.
You know, we were just talking about the Mormon Tabernacle Choir on a previous show, and the singers in the front row won't be there next year.
Oh, oh my.
That's how that works.
They can rotate only, down.
Yes, they rotate down, and the front row is the final, that's their final year in the choir.
Wow.
That's how it works.
Sometimes you'd get a little more graphic. You are a cancer, and you need to be cut out.
Oh, dear.
I can sing it your way, but you can't sing it my way. I don't like your way.
Those are great lines. Just fabulous lines.
He would say, that tone's a little hairy. Shave it.
I won't drive in a car with you because you never look up.
Oh.
Yep. And the list goes on.
And the list goes on. Well, Paul didn't just sing in church and sing in the Dorothy Chandler, and actually did even one concert with the Master Chorale in the Disney Hall.
Yes, he did.
Sold out concert. But he made TV scores, films. He was just everywhere. Any place there was music making in Los Angeles or the world, he was part of the scene.
He was one of the better, that's a subjective term, I guess, but he was a well-loved contractor for movie soundtracks because he could deliver a really warm and rich product for all kinds of films, most of which we've all seen.
Can you tell us a few? I know he sang on many as well.
He did. As a singer, he sang on How the West Was Won, Paint Your Wagon.
Trouble with Angels, one of my favorites.
And then later years, we did sound when he was contracting. One of the very first ones we did was Flatliners, Waterworld, Bram Stoker's Dracula,
Well, the list goes on and on.
Yes, it does.
And This Wonderful World lost Paul Solomonowicz on April 4th. His wife, Dottie, survives after 64 years of marriage together. And his wonderful family, there's a great Facebook page. You'll hear all these cuts on our website, ChristCathedralMusic.org. But right now, we want to cut to a piece by Morton Lauritsen.
The Luxic Terna was maybe, in a sense, a real pinnacle for Skip Lauritsen as a composer. He wrote it specifically for Paul. Said that Paul was in every single note of the piece, and it really is a glorious work. And we had a great time. Dominic and I both were on the recording sessions at Loyola Marymount in Sacred Heart Chapel, where we had made so much music with Paul to begin with. So it was a real full circle moment for
us. What a pleasure to have both of you here, Don McKellar and Jim Dronger. Just reminiscing about Paul through this hour has been fantastic.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Music from the Tower. Until next time, I encourage you to go out and listen to some great music and live performance. This is John Romero thanking you for listening to Music from the Tower.